We started a discussion on Tuesday about the mitzvah of Kibud Av V'Em, and we gave a little bit of the background to this mitzvah. Now, let us get into some of the practical applications and some, perhaps, of the complications that may be relevant to a number of you in this room. Anyone who is in this room and is dating may encounter at some point in your dating career, which hopefully will be very short-lived, and you'll get to the right one at the right time very quickly. And in your dating experience, you may have an opportunity to meet someone that you are very excited to marry and you are very excited to spend the rest of your life with. And then, lo and behold, you introduce them to your parents and just doesn't go. And your parents are like, I really don't like this person, or I really would appreciate if you would not marry this person. Things like that can happen. And the question is, of course, on a practical level, our parents have life experience. Maybe our parents see things that we don't see. Maybe they're not blinded by the things that we are emotionally blinded by. So it may be a good idea to listen to our parents anyway. But what would the halacha say? Forgetting practically, should we listen to our parents or not is a practical question. But in terms of what would the halacha demand of a person when their parents object to a shidduch, when their parents object to the person who they want to marry, do I have an obligation because of Kibud Av V'Em to listen to my parents' requests, or do I have a right to ignore them and make the decision that I feel is right for myself? Similarly, I was just talking upstairs to the Mechanechet, Mrs. Cement, and she asked me, what are you going to teach about? So I said, this is one of the issues. She said, well, it's not really so relevant here because most of the women in Stern College date on their own, and then, like, you know, their parents really aren't involved. So I said, it still is relevant because at some point your parents are going to be involved. I hope they're going to meet the person who you plan to marry, and they may say yes and they may say no. So it is relevant. But the second question perhaps is even more relevant. Say, for example, you may have someone in the room who wants to make aliyah, and your parents are very adamant that they don't want you to make aliyah, not because they hate Eretz Yisrael and not because they have anything against you, but because they think that right now the best opportunity for your future is in the United States, or the best opportunity for you to, whatever, to be successful is to stay here and not to go to Eretz Yisrael. Am I allowed to make aliyah against my parents' wishes? That is a very important question. Now, once again, practically, it may be smart to listen to our parents because our parents know us very well, have invested a lot in us, understand life perhaps more maturely than we do, have a world of life experience that we don't have, so maybe it makes sense to listen to them regardless. But what does the Torah say about our obligation of Kibud Av V'Em in these kinds of conflicts, in these kinds of situations? So let's back it up a little bit, and let's first ask ourselves a very basic question. We have many mitzvahs that we perform, that we observe throughout the course, throughout the duration of the year. We have some mitzvahs which are midaraisa, some mitzvahs which are midirabanan. So we shake the lulav, we sit in the sukkah, we keep Shabbos, we have kiddush, we light Shabbos candles, we do all kinds of different things during the year. We almost always make a bracha on the mitzvahs that we do. So we light Shabbos candles and make a bracha, l'hadlik ner shel Shabbos. Now, lighting Shabbos candles is a mitzvah midaraisa, a biblical obligation, or midirabanan? Midirabanan. So why do you say, asher kedishanu b'mitzvosa v'tzivanu, ask the Gemara. It's a Gemara Masechet Shabbos. How can you make a bracha that God gave me, endowed me with kedusha, and therefore, that is why I'm doing this mitzvah? Vitzivanu, because you commanded me, but you didn't command me. Who commanded me to do it? The Chachamim, 2,500 years ago, are the ones who commanded me to do this. So, how can I say Vitzivanu, asked the Gemara? Heichan Sivanu, when did HaKadosh Baruch Hu actually command us to do this? And the answer, says the Gemara, is because HaKadosh Baruch Hu in the Torah said, Lo sasar min adavar asher yagidu l'cha yaminu smol. We have a mitzvah not only to listen to the explicit words of the Torah, but also to listen to the Chachamim, who teach us how to live lives as Torah Jews. And therefore, based on that, the Gemara says you're allowed to make a bracha, asher kedishanu b'mitzvos v'tzivanu, whether you're performing a mitzvah midaraisa, like shaking lulav, like sitting in sukkah, or if you're doing a mitzvah derabanan, like lighting Hanukkah candles, reading the Megillah, or lighting the candles on Erev Shabbos, whatever it may be, you're always supposed to make a bracha. Now, we make different kinds of brachos in different kinds of times and experiences in our lives. We have what we refer to as a birchas hanenin. Birchas hanenin means when I'm having hana'a, which means when I'm benefiting from something, I recite a bracha. So before I take a drink, before I eat something, I have to recite a bracha, says the Gemara, because kalanena min ha'olam hazeh b'lo bracha ki ilu mal. It's a Gemara Maseches Brachos. If I have benefit from something without first making a bracha on it, it is as if I'm stealing from the property of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, from God's property himself. So therefore, you always have to make a bracha before you have hana'a. We have a second category of brachas that is referred to as a birchas hashevach, What is a berachas hashevach? That means I give praise to HaKadosh Baruch Hu for something amazing that I experience or that I see. So for example, I go to Niagara Falls, I see something incredibly amazing, I see one of the wonders of the world, I make a berachas hashevach. If I hear thunder or if I see lightning or something of that nature, if I see a rainbow, I will make a berachas hashevach. That we recite before or after. What do you say? You go to Niagara Falls. Before you see the falls, you make the bracha, or after? After. Why after? Because the point of the bracha is, I'm so overwhelmed by what I see, I have to praise God as a reaction, as a response to what I've seen, to what I've experienced. So when it comes to a berachas hanenin, when it comes to something that I'm enjoying now, I first need to say a bracha, and then I have a right to enjoy it. When it comes to a bracha that I'm reciting because I'm so overwhelmed by the presence of God in the world, I first see the incredible sight, and then I react by saying a bracha. What is the halacha when it comes to a birchas ha-mitzvah? When I have to make a bracha on a mitzvah that I'm about to perform, should I make the bracha before or after? What? So the Gemara says, Imsachim davav, in Maseches Sukkah, Daf Lamedtes, the Gemara says, Kol ha-mitzvos kulan mevarech aleihem over la'asiyasam. Every time one performs a mitzvah, they have to make a bracha before they perform the mitzvah. That is what we're supposed to do. And the Rishonim explain why we do that. It's basically to frame the activity that I'm doing. It's in order that I should understand and that others should understand. The reason why I'm doing this is not just because I'm a nice person. The reason I'm doing it is because this is what I was commanded to do. And it basically frames the action that I'm about to do. So when it comes to the mitzvah of Kibud Av V'Em, suddenly we find that there is no mitzvah. Say, for example, I'm going to make my parents a coffee in the morning. So why don't we say, before you prepare the drink, before you make the coffee, before you bring it into the living room to give it back to your parent, why don't you make a bracha asher kedushanu mitzvos ha-betzivanu l'chabed es aviv v'simo. Whatever bracha it's going to be. L'chabed es ha'av v'em. Why don't we make such a bracha just like we would for any other mitzvah that we do during the year? There are a number of interesting answers that are given to this. Number one, the Rashba, one of the Gedoli HaRishonim, says, the only time I can make a bracha on a mitzvah is when it is totally dependent on me. So I have a lulav and esrog. I make a bracha before I shake the lulav and esrog because it's my decision whether I'm going to do the mitzvah or not. But he says, when the mitzvah requires somebody else to participate, to cooperate with me, I am not 100% certain that they are going to accept. So say, for example, says the Rashba, you have a poor person comes to your house collecting money. And you go, you say, okay, let me go get my checkbook, I'll be right back. As you go to get the checkbook, maybe the person is so humiliated, is so embarrassed, maybe they're going to run away. So I'm going to sit there and make a bracha, asher kedushanu mitzvos ha-betzivanu al mitzvahs hatzdaka. And then it turns out that I have no one to give the tzedakah to. So that was a bracha levatala. You're not allowed to make a bracha for no reason. And it would turn out that in that scenario, I made a bracha with really no purpose at all. Same would be by any mitzvah where I have another individual that is required to participate in the mitzvah with me, I would not recite a bracha, says the Rashba, because we're concerned that maybe I will not be able to fulfill my mitzvah because maybe the other partner, the other participant, is not going to come through on the other end of the deal. And therefore, the same would be over here. Let's say I make my parents a coffee, then I walk into the living room and I say, okay, give me 1 second. Before I give you the coffee, let me make a bracha. The parent says, you know what? I changed my mind. I really don't want the coffee. Then it turns out, why'd you make the bracha? There was no mitzvah of Kibud Av V'Em. So therefore, says the Rashba, that is the reason why we don't make a bracha on the mitzvah of Kibud Av V'Em. Yeah. What about it?
You say a bracha. What else does the mitzvah?
Okay, but the child doesn't have a right to object.
Not always a child.
Not always a child, so that's true. An adult who has a bris milah, who makes the bracha for them? Good question. Seemingly the adult, right? It's a great question. So the Rashba says that we do not recite a bracha whenever you require two parties to fulfill a mitzvah. Another answer, an interesting suggestion that is given in the Sefer Stei Chemed, which was written in the early 1900s, he quotes that perhaps the reason why is because when you have a mitzvah like the mitzvah of Kibud Av V'Em, like the mitzvah of shaking lulav, like sitting in sukkah, like lighting Hanukkah candles, it is very defined what the mitzvah is and what the mitzvah is not. However, he says, when it comes to the mitzvah of Kibud Av V'Em, it's so difficult to get it exactly right. And therefore, he says, if I don't really know whether I'm doing the mitzvah 100% properly, I don't know whether I'm actually doing it the way I'm supposed to, then how can I recite a bracha on that? I know when I'm lighting Hanukkah candles, I'm doing the mitzvah as I'm supposed to do it. I know when I'm doing many other mitzvahs throughout the year, it's pretty easy to do, not easy, but I know exactly what is expected of me. Comes to the mitzvah of kibud av v'aim, there are so many different layers of how I can do it. Even the attitude with which I have to respect my parents or to service them would also make a difference in the mitzvah of kibud av v'aim and in the manifestation of that mitzvah as well. And therefore, he says, because it is so difficult to actually perform this mitzvah properly, therefore, we do not recite a bracha on it. And the third reason that is given is because what will you do in a case when you have a mamzer? Mamzer means you have two people who are not allowed to be married to each other, but who get married anyway and then have a child. That illegitimate child also has parents. Now, those parents weren't allowed to marry each other, but they did anyway, and they gave birth to this young boy or girl, and now the child has to respect their parents. So what am I going to say? Thank you, Hashem, for giving me the mitzvah to respect my parents who are such terrible people. Right? That would be like a very strange thing to make a bracha on. And therefore, because we don't want the mamzer to have to make a bracha on the mitzvah of kibud av v'aim, therefore we made one uniform standard that nobody makes a bracha on kibud av v'aim, as not to humiliate, as not to embarrass that individual who is unable to make the bracha on being mechabed their parents who did something wrong. Yeah. Other than what? Yeah, so make you do make a bracha, but that's not so much ben al-chaver. That's really an obligation I have, that lo sasim damim b'beisecha, that I have a personal obligation. The Rashba argues that there are no mitzvahs ben adam l'chavera where you would make a bracha. That's what he argues. Yeah. Good point. Okay, now, we started in last year, we mentioned that in Parshas Kedoshim, the Torah repeats again, not only in the Aseres Hadibros in Parshas Yisro and in Parshas Va'eschanan, but in Parshas Kedoshim, the Torah mentions the mitzvah of kibud av v'aim as well. But there we have an interesting formulation. There the Torah says, Ishi mova aviv tiro ve'es shabsosai tishmoru. So in one phrase, we seem to have two very different themes. Ishi mova aviv tiro means I have a mitzvah to honor and fear my parents. And then, es shabsosai tishmoru, I have a totally separate, independent mitzvah of observing Shabbos. Why are these two things found in the same pasuk? Art Scroll uses the word juxtaposed. I don't think anyone has ever used the word juxtaposed outside of Art Scroll, right? So why are these two things juxtaposed to each other? Why do we have the mitzvah of kibud av v'aim and the mitzvah of observing Shabbos in the same pasuk? What is the connection? That is the question that is asked in the Gemara Maseches Yevamos Daf Hei, also Gemara Maseches Baba Metzia, I think Lamed Aleph, Lamed Beis, where the Gemara asks the same question. Why are these two things put in the same pasuk? The answer, says the Gemara, is because kulchem chayavim bechvodi, which means when we say you have a mitzvah of kibud av v'aim, yes, of course, kibud av v'aim is very important. And yes, of course, l'man yarichun yamecha, you will get a long life and you are blessed with a wonderful schar, with a wonderful reward, if you go ahead and you make sure to respect your parents. However, if your parents instruct you to violate Shabbos, you are not allowed to listen to them. So say, for example, my parent says to me, please drive me to the supermarket, I need to buy a few things. Please drive me to the movie theater, I want to go watch a movie. You are not allowed to listen to your parents, even though it means that you are violating kibud av v'aim, because Shabbos is more important than kibud av v'aim. And the lashon, the language that the Gemara uses, is kulchem chayavim bechvodi. You and your parents have an obligation to respect me. So the Ribono Shel Olam says, why is it that you're listening to your parents when they say kibud av v'aim demands of you to do this? Because you have respect for your parents. Yeah, but your parents and you are subsumed under me, the Ribono Shel Olam. And therefore he says, that is why the Gemara assumes that if one's parent tells them to do something that is against the laws of the Torah, we are not supposed to listen to them. We should completely disregard what it is that they say. The Dubna Magid gives an interesting mashal to explain why this is the case. It says the Dubna Magid as follows. There are three brothers, three, I guess he says they're triplets, I don't know what they are, but they finished their primary education and now it's time for them to go to university. So they're trying to figure out where they're going to go. And they talk to their parents about it. The parents say, listen, don't go in our community. We don't have higher education. We don't have any opportunities for you. We're going to send you away to the top-notch universities, wherever it may be. You're going to travel far away. All of you are going to go study and learn whatever it is that you want to specialize in. And the three of them go into three different professions, and they go to school for three different things. They all end up in the same school, but they learn three different miktsaot. They learn three different, not professions, but three different traits. Thank you. So one of them learns how to build, he's like a scientist a little bit, he learns how to create, how to manufacture a telescope. Amazing. Fine. So he makes this unbelievable breakthrough in science. Everyone's celebrating it. Unbelievable. The second one learns how to make very high-powered horse and buggies. He's an engineer. He figures out how to have the wheels move as quickly as they can and how to go to wherever the destination is. And even if it gets stuck in the mud, he figures it out. Amazing. Brilliant advancement in science. The third goes to medical school and he learns how to treat patients who are sick. Okay. All three of them come home and they're together with their parents again after they finished all of their education. And each one is talking about whatever it is that they learned. One fine day, Mr. Telescope takes out his telescope and he starts looking and he sees in the distance, in a town very far away, he's able to see and he zooms in to see what's going on there. He notices that there's a big commotion going on. So he zooms in a little bit more and he sees the daughter of the king, the princess, is very, very sick. And everyone is crowding around trying to figure out what to do and nobody knows what to do. So he turns to his brothers and he says, listen, we got this. With my telescope, I was able to see what's going on, but I can't do anything about it. So the three of us are going to put our heads together. We're going to figure out this problem. My telescope found the problem. Your expertise in making a wagon is going to help us get there. And your expertise in being a medical doctor is going to be able to save the princess. Can you imagine? Isn't this amazing? So the three of them put their heads together. They make this whole plan. They make the wagon. The doctor gets on the back of it. And they all travel to the city where the king's daughter is very sick. And when they show up, the king asks them, you know, what are you coming for? What brings you here? Mr. Telescope says, you know, I had this invention and you're not going to believe it, but I was able to see from a very far away distance what was going on here. My brother happens to know how to make wagons, so he brought us here. My other brother is a medical doctor. Between the three of us, we figured out what the problem was, and here we are to save your daughter. And lo and behold, the medical doctor gets involved, and he saves the life of this young princess whose life is in danger. Okay. The king is so grateful to everybody that has contributed to his daughter's good health. So he turns to them and he says, well, of course, one of you is going to marry my daughter. She can't have three husbands. And now the brothers start fighting. Mr. Telescope says, without me, you would never have known there was a problem here. So I'm the one who deserves all the credit here. Mr. Wagon says, listen, I appreciate everything that you contributed to this problem, but without my wagon, you would have been stuck in the other neighborhood. You would have never gotten here. By the time you walked all of these miles, she would have been dead already. The doctor says, you're both great. I love both of you. But without me, she would still be sick. So you could see everything you want to see and you could travel everywhere you want to go, but you have nothing to provide them with once you get here. So of course, everything rests on my shoulders and I'm the one who deserves the credit. And the three brothers are fighting who deserves the most credit and who should be the one to marry this princess. Fine. The king notices that he's not getting anywhere. He finally decides, let me turn to my daughter and ask her, what do you want? Which should have been the first question. Who do you want to marry? So she turns to the three of them and she says, listen, I appreciate everything that all of you have done. Of course, you collaborated together to save my life. And without any of the three of you, I never would be able to survive this illness. But who am I going to choose from the three of you? What would he say? It's obvious. The doctor. Why? Because if I get sick later, if I get sick again, Mr. Telescope is not going to help me. Mr. Wagon is not going to help me. The doctor is going to get me better. So of the three of you, the one that I think is the smartest choice for myself is the doctor. Because in the future, I can call on the doctor's expertise to be able to help and assist me in any medical crisis I may have. What does that have to do with this? Says the Dubna Magid. It's true. The Gemara says, Shlosha Shutfim Ba'ada. Every human being has three partners that brought them into the world. Of course, without a father, you can't have a child. Without a mother, you can't have a child either. Who's more important? Well, yes, the mother carries the child for 9 months, but without a father, she wouldn't be able to ever conceive that child. Now, of course, now there are other ways, but naturally, that is the way that a child comes into the world. So without a father and a mother, it's impossible. Without God involved in both of them, nothing would have happened. So you have three equal partners who all contribute to the safety and well-being of every human being. And because of that, we have to show respect and gratitude to all of them, to our fathers, to our mothers, and to the Ribono Shel Olam, and to God himself. Now, what happens when you have to make a decision? Who are you going to respect more? What we were talking about here is, my parent tells me to be Mechal Shabbos, and I am conflicted now. On the one hand, God tells me, don't be Mechal HaShabbos. On the other hand, my parent says, do be Mechal HaShabbos. So who should I listen to? What's the answer? You should listen to the Ribbono Shel Olam. Listen to God who said you should keep Shabbos. Why? Why is he more important? All three of the partners in my life are equally as important. Without my father, I wouldn't be here. Without my mother, I wouldn't be here. Without God, I wouldn't be here. So why is he more important? The answer is, because later on in my life, an investment into the future, the best investment I can make is playing on God's team. There are going to be situations in my life where my father can't help me, where my mother can't help me, as wonderful as they are, but where only the Ribbono Shel Olam can help me, and therefore our Kodesh Baruch Hu says, Kulchem Chayavim Bechvodi, when it comes down to it, I am the most valuable of all three of these players here. I am the medical doctor, Ani Hashem Rofecha. I am the one who has the ability to sustain you, to help you, to assist you later on in your lives, and therefore, when you are faced with a conflict of what exactly you should do, the answer is, the Ribbono Shel Olam always wins. And based on this, the Gemara says that if our parents instruct us that we should violate one of the mitzvos or averus in the Torah, we should not listen to them. We should listen to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and that is unequivocally clear in the Shulchan Aruch as well. Now, one of the fundamental principles and guiding principles in Kibbutz Ava'im is the Gemara Maseches Kiddushin. So the Gemara has the following question. Let's just give a scenario. Let's say my parents don't know how to use the internet, don't know how to use a computer, they don't know how to book themselves a ticket, they don't know how to book themselves a rental car, they don't know how to do these things. Okay, so because I'm growing up in our generation, so I know how to do it, and I'm available to help them. So now they say to me, you know, we're working so hard, we really need a vacation, we got to go to, where should we go?
Italy,
of course. So we go to Italy. Now, very exciting, they're going to have a nice vacation in Italy, they're going to visit your house, and you're going to take care of them, sounds great. But they don't know how to book the ticket, so they turn to one of us and they say, can you please book us a ticket and also a rental car for when we're there? And I say, sure, I'm happy to. So I start surfing around on the internet trying to find, you know, the best rates, best tickets, and I arrange everything. Who's supposed to pay for that? So, like, I find a good rate and I'm like, okay, you want to give me your credit card? They're like, no. Like, you're a child. Keep it on hand. Come on. What do you say? Maybe the trip to Italy is not such a good idea anymore.
They would never ask me to pay for them.
Your parents wouldn't, but some people's parents would, right?
Yeah.
Not everyone's parents are like yours. So the question is, am I, as a child, obligated to pay for my parents' vacation? What do you say? You're not sure? What do you think?
No.
Let's say, Matt, let me give you an extreme example. I live in a beautiful house. My parents come into the house one day and they say, wow, that's like a beautiful piece of art you have on the wall. Where'd you get it from? I bid for it. I won at an auction. How much did you pay? $3.5 million. Not my house, right? But $3.5 million. It was like an old painting from the 1700s. They preserved it. Amazing. Very famous artist. You saw this, that there's a painting going for $12 million from the early 1800s of the Western Wall? Yesterday's news. Nobody follows the news here. All right, it's good. Shouldn't. So, there's nothing good there. You're not missing anything. The world is still here, maybe for a little bit longer, and then we'll see what happens. So, we'll let you know when the status changes. Don't worry. So, what happens? So, my parent walks into the house and says, you know, it's a really beautiful painting. It would look so good in our dining room. You mind if we take it? I'm like, sure, give me $3.5 million, you're welcome to take it. Are you crazy? I'm your parent. Like, keep it of aim. What's wrong with you? So that's called, in our language, stealing. Right? Even if it's our parents, and even if they really want it, either it's called stealing or it's called lo sachmod. Lo sachmod means if they just come to my house and start coveting all the valuable things I have and they try to convince me that I should give it to them, even if I willingly end up giving it to them, that's not allowed. It's either lo signo or lo sachmo. So that's not allowed. But what about kibud avaim? What about kibud avaim? So the answer, says the Gemara, is kibud avaim is mishal av velo mishal ben. That's here in the second line. Says the Gemara, kibud av is mishal av. I have an obligation to respect my parents and to provide them with services. So if they need help because their printer is not working, if they need help because they don't know how to book their flights to Italy to go visit you, or because of any other reason, I have to help them and assist them as much as I can. However, when it comes time to pay, I do not have an obligation to pay. My parents have the obligation to pay, and if they don't want to pay, then I do not have an obligation to pick up the bill, even though I know that they want this very badly. I would have no obligation to do so, which is why the Shulchan Aruch writes the following case in Yerodea. Let's say I have a parent who is in a very difficult financial struggle, and they don't have money to take care of their monthly expenses. So, do I have an obligation to take care of my parents? What's the answer? We're talking about real. I'm not talking about excess. I'm talking about my parents can't pay the water bill. So do I have an obligation as a child to pay their water bill?
It might be different if they don't have money.
We're talking they don't have money.
So maybe you have money to support yourself?
I have money. I have plenty of money. I have extra money. So you would say, Kibbut Av Ha'Em would say, I have an obligation to take care of my parents? Wrong. Says the Shulchan Aruch, what? Exactly. Says the Shulchan Aruch, it's not a mitzvah of Kibbut Av Ha'Em. Kibbut Av Ha'Em would not demand of me to spend money to take care of my parents, even if they are in dire need. The mitzvah of tzedakah would demand of me to take care of them. I should be charitable. And says the Gemara, says the Shulchan Aruch, I should certainly prioritize my parents over any other charity in the world. If my parents are in need, I should cut back from my giving to any other good organization or institution, and I should focus on my parents being taken care of before anybody else. In fact, the Chasam Sofer writes that you are not allowed to give to anything else before you take care of your parents. But make no mistake, the Shulchan Aruch does say that even though I should be a nice person and I should provide my parents if they can't pay the water bill, that does not mean that it's part of the mitzvah of Kibbut Av Ha'Em. That is simply the mitzvah of tzedakah, of charity that I share with many other poor people in the world who I should be helping to take care of. My parents get priority to everyone else because I should feel much closer to them. But the mitzvah of Kibbut Av Ha'Em would not demand of an individual to take care of their parents financially. And that is why Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach writes about the following case. He says, what happens if you have an individual who lives in Chile, right? So the individual, for argument's sake, lives in Chile, right, Hannah? So the individual lives in Chile, and I'm sorry, you're in Stern College and your parents live in Chile. Your parents go up and say, Hannah, we miss you. Can you come visit us? So you say, I would love to visit you. I miss you too. But like, it's very expensive. I don't know what it costs, but it's very expensive to go fly to Chile, right? Correct? I assume. Very expensive to go to Chile. So your parents say, yeah, but you have a mitzvah, keep it up, eh? Like, we'd love to see you. So says the Shlomo Zalman, who's supposed to pay for the ticket? Who's supposed to pay for the ticket? The answer, he says, is your parents have to pay for the ticket. If they want to see you because it's Kibbut Av Ha'Em for them, you don't have to spend money to go visit them. They have to spend the money to have you been given the opportunity to come see them. Now, says Rav Shlomo Zalman, if you want to sit business class, that's your expense. Your parents have to pay for a normal fare, which most average people would use to get from place A to place B. Now, anything beyond that, you want to fly a different class, you want to fly a private jet, you want to do whatever you want, that's your expense. But if my parents want me to come see them, the baseline of my travel expenses has to be spent by them. There's a story about Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, which is a very fascinating story. They say that somebody once came to Reb Chaim Soloveitchik and said, my parents want me to come visit them, but they didn't send me money for the train to get to them. So he said, okay, so start walking. I don't think that's a reasonable expectation. I think he was just trying to prove to him that like he should be a little bit understanding of his parents. Of course, the expectation is not that you're going to walk and swim to Chile. That's not what anyone expects of you. The expectation is your parents are going to provide you a normal way to get there, and if they're not willing to pay for it, you're not mechuyav to do it. Okay, now why are we saying all of this? Because this brings us to a very important issue that we mentioned before. Many times in the Shulchan Aruch, the Rama quotes from the Maharik. The Maharik was a great gadol who lived in the 1400s. The Rama lived in the 1500s, so he was very influenced by the positions of the Maharik. And on this issue, the Rama in Yerodea Siman Reish Mem, which is the laws of Kibbut Av Ha'Em, quotes the Maharik. What does the Maharik say here? So let's see. The Maharik is talking about a case where a young man or a young woman decide that they have met the person who they want to marry. The only problem is that my parents don't agree. So I'm dating, and I feel very emotionally connected, and I feel that I'm very interested in progressing, and now I introduce the prospective spouse to my parents, and my parents say, are you crazy? You're going to bring this person home? We don't want this person in our family. We don't want to have anything to do with them. This is not the right shidduch. This is not the right kind of boy. not the right kind of family, not the right kind of grandparents, whatever it is, whatever it may be, your parents don't like the shidduch. Do I have an obligation to listen to my parents because of kivud av v'aim? So what would you say? You say no. Why not? You don't know. You assume the answer is no. So the Maharik, as quoted by the Rama, says you do not have to listen to your parents. Why do you not have to listen to your parents? Yeah?
Well, we said about Shabbos, and I told you that you have to listen, and if,
correct.
If there's a mitzvah to get married, and you're standing in the way, then maybe you don't.
Okay, excellent. So a number of reasons are given for this. Number one, because what did we just say? When there's a mitzvah of kibud av v'aim, who has to pay for it? My parents have to pay for it. They can't put the expenses on me. I don't have to pay for it. And if that is the expectation, if that's the case, then when it comes to a financial burden, I don't have to pick up the bill. Then when it comes to an emotional burden, that for the rest of my life I'm going to want to marry this person and I'm not able to because my parents don't let me, do you think that the Torah would expect me to listen to my parents there? If I don't have to listen to them to pay for the expenses, then how can I be expected to have to listen to them for something that's much more important than money? Getting married is much more important than how much money I have. So if for my money I don't have to listen to my parents, then certainly if my parents are trying to destroy the rest of my life by convincing me not to marry this person, or by saying that because of kibud av v'aim you can't be married to this individual, that is not an expectation that I have an obligation to go along with. That's not, kibud av v'aim would not dictate that. Number two, like you very correctly said, what did we mention before? If my parents tell me that kibud av v'aim would say that I should violate Shabbos, I should drive them to the movies, I should bring them to the supermarket, I'm not allowed to do that because kulchem chayavim bechvodi. We all share an obligation to respect HaKadosh Baruch Hu even more than our parents. And therefore, if there's a conflict, if there's a clash between what our parents want and what the Ribono Shel Olam wants, we're going to go with God and we're going to leave our parents behind. Unfortunately, but that's the way it is. So here, if I have a mitzvah to get married, I have a mitzvah to have children, I have a mitzvah to live that kind of life, who are my parents to say, don't marry this person? Now, you'll say, what do you mean? There's a million other boys in the world. All of us who are in the dating scene are very well aware of the fact that there aren't a million other boys in the world. And maybe this person that I'm dating is the right one. And I am concerned that if I'm going to ruin this prospect, this possibility of marrying this person, maybe, just maybe, I will not meet the right one later. So what right would my parents have to tell me not to marry them if, after all, that is going to get in the way of my capacity, of my ability to fulfill the mitzvah of kiddushin, of nisuin, of puravu, of sheves, of all the different things that we have an obligation to get married and raise families? Therefore, says the Maharik, for those reasons we assume that one does not have an obligation to listen to their parents if the parents object to a shidduch. Look at the story that Rabbi Yitzchak Yosef writes in the Yalkut Yosef, quoting from his father, Rabbi Avadi Yosef. He says, V'zachruni, and I remember, Lefnei Yosef me'arbayim shana, I remember that more than 40 years ago, Kasher Bito Shal Echad Harabanim B'ma'arechas Hadayanus De'az, there was a rabbi who was in the Rabbanut in Eretz Yisrael at the time, Hishtadcha Im Chasan Svardi Yarei Shamayim. The daughter of this rabbi in the Rabbanut got engaged to a Svardi boy who was a great boy. Ve'aviha Hisnagi Lekach B'chol Tokef. And the father, who was a dayan in the Rabbanut, was angry that his daughter was marrying the Svardi boy. Now, there's nothing wrong with the boy. So why do you not like it? Because he's a Svardi? So what? So he's a Svardi. So you're an Ashkenazi? What's the difference? He's a good Jew. What's the problem? Maran Adoni Avi Moir Virabi Nasa Labeso Samach L'chupa. My father, Rabbi Avadi Yosef, went to the home of this father, of the girl's father, right before the chupa. L'shachno Lavo L'chupa. And he was trying to twist his arm. Come to your daughter's wedding. Your daughter's getting married tonight. Come to the wedding. Stop standing on ceremony. Stop getting in the way of the shidduch. V'diber alibo rabos, and my father spent a lot of time there, and he tried to convince his father below alabiyado, and he got nowhere, and he was not successful. Libasov, and in the end, maran adoni avi mori virabi arach es hanisuin, my father Rabbi Avadi Yosef was the mesada kedushin that night, below nochachos ahorum, and the parents did not show up to the wedding. La'achar shenisharu ba'akshanusam, because they were so stubborn and they would not budge after my father tried convincing them, They wouldn't hear it, and therefore my father said, well, we're going to go ahead with the wedding without you. Tragic, very sad, but that's what happened. That's what he says. Now, all sounds like it makes a lot of sense, until you come, in the 1800s, to the Netziv. The Netziv, in his Shalos HaTshuvas Meshiv Davar, writes, not so simple. Although it's true that I don't have an obligation of Kibud Av V'Em toward my parents when they're trying to get in the way of my Shidduch, for a number of reasons, either because, just like I don't have to pay monetarily for Kibud Av V'Em, so too I don't have to pay such a horrible emotional price for the rest of my life that I'm going to be upset that I didn't marry this person. And secondly, the reason why I don't have to listen is because my parents are ostensibly telling me to violate Mitzvah HaTorah. So I don't have to listen to my parents in such a situation. Says the Meshiv Davar, says the Netziv, that's all true, so long as it's not causing my parents a bizayon. If I'm causing my parents a bizayon, then he says, bizayon ava'im is very, very serious. Bizayon means I'm doing something disgraceful to them. I'm doing something that is going to be a black mark on their family. So if I'm causing a bizayon to my parents, then I have no right to do that. So if this shidduch is going to be something that is going to cause them so much embarrassment, then he says, you would not be allowed to ignore your parents. Kibud Av V'Em would dictate that you must listen to your parents and you must break the shidduch because it's going to cause them too much bizayon. That's what he says. And then he proves how we know that bizayon Av V'Em is worse, is more severe than regular Kibud Av V'Em, and why the rules might change a little bit. Now, that's a very nice comment to make in theory. However, you have to really think about that very carefully. That's a very subjective term. What is a bizayon? Well, it depends who you ask. If you ask me, I would say, do you know what this Mechutin's family has in their house? You walk in and you see they have a car that's not leased, but it's bought. That's a big bizayon to my family. Is everyone sleeping? Everyone has their own threshold of what they think is considered to be a bizayon. Correct? Some people have ridiculous imaginations of what would be a bizayon to them. Some people would say, you know, on Shabbos they use these kinds of tablecloths instead of those kinds of tablecloths, and they serve on china or paper. This is silly. That's what's going to determine the rest of your life, whether the shidduch makes sense? That's not relevant. So along comes the Tzitz Eliezer, and he says, we need to qualify a little bit this comment of the Netziv. While it's true that if objectively there is a family that is a tremendous bizayon to my parents, then yes, maybe I shouldn't marry this individual because I will cause too much embarrassment to them. But if we're talking about things that the parents are getting hung up on that are not really objectively a bizayon at all, just they feel very uncomfortable with it, we don't let them break a shidduch just because of that. So it says in Tzitz Eliezer, it has to be a very serious issue that the parents have, which is going to be something that is objectively to the standards of many others a bizayon to our parents. And therefore he says that is the only time that we would say that the Netziv's words are correct. But outside of that, which is usually most of the cases, right? What do the parents say? What's the problem? Why can't you marry this person? What are the objections people give?
Conversions.
Rav Asher Weiss said to me a few weeks ago, we were talking about, I forgot what it was. We were talking about conversions. So we were talking about this issue, and he said, you know, we live in a very mixed up world where nobody really knows anymore where the real, very few people know where their real yichus is from. Some families have a tree that goes all the way back, but most people, you know, they assume my mother, my father, my this, my that. You don't really know so far back. So he said, the people who have the cleanest slate are the ones who are converts. The ones that we know had a halachic conversion. We're not talking about questionable conversions down the line. We're talking about one generation ago where we know the conversion was done in a pure and kosher halachic way. Can you get a more kosher gene than that? Can you get a more Jewish person than that? All the rest of us, we don't know whether or not our lineage goes back all the way back to Moshe Rabbeinu, to Avraham Avinu. I don't know. But somebody we know is certainly a Jew. Who's that? The convert. So that's a good point to consider. But again, it's something to think about. I think that Tzitz Eliezer's point here is one which really needs some consideration, because you need to think about when somebody raises an objection to a shidduch, how legitimate is their objection, and is it something that we should really take seriously or perhaps not. Rav Moshe Feinstein actually writes in a tshuva, I didn't put it on here, he discusses in Yerudei Chelek Gimel Negris Moshe, what is the halacha about smoking marijuana? So he gets into a whole discussion. And then in the end, he throws in a line and he says, don't you think it's going to be a bizayon or it's going to cause tremendous pain to my parents to know that their child is smoking marijuana? Now, I don't know that Rav Moshe knew that a kid who's smoking marijuana probably couldn't care less how much pain it's causing their parents. I don't know. But Rav Moshe writes that it's something to consider. Something to consider. He said, even though it's true, if you want to do something in your life that you feel will benefit you, your parents can't stand in the way of that. Right? Like we find over here. Getting married to someone who you want to marry, they don't want you to marry, you don't have to listen to them. But on the other hand, says Rav Moshe, if by your decision to do whatever it is that you're doing, you're going to cause pain to your parents, that is something you're not allowed to do. And therefore, he says, smoking marijuana is probably not a good idea anyway. But beyond that, he says, you're going to cause a lot of pain to your parents. And therefore, he says, kibud av v'em would be a very serious factor involved there. Yeah.
What if your parents want different things from you? Like, what if they're not agreeing? Do you go by there?
Depends what it is. Like, one parent wants you to marry this boy, and one parent doesn't want you to marry this boy?
Or without, not even about children, like, anything. Like, if one parent's going to do something, and one parent's going to do something.
So, the Ramah actually has a very interesting case. The Ramah talks about a case. What happens when one parent, God forbid, passes away? So, what is the custom? The custom is that the children say Kaddish. But the other parent is still alive. And the other parent says, like, I'm not comfortable. It gives me, like, the heebie-jeebies. If you're going to say Kaddish, it makes me feel like, you know, like I'm not here. Yeah, but I'm doing it out of respect to my mother and my father, and you happen to be the other spouse who's alive, but this is the respectful thing to do. So the Ramah does talk about that. In that situation, what do you do when you have a conflict between the two parents when I'm trying to be mechabed one, but it seems that by doing that, I'm going to be slighting the other one? So he does discuss the variable that you just mentioned. Talk about it another time. Okay, then... Actually, the Torah Tamima, I think, raises an issue on Chumash, where he wants to know what happened. Yitzchak Avinu wants Yaakov to find the Shidduch. So what does he do? Tells Yaakov, go out and find a nice girl. Sounds good. But what does he tell him? Lo, you're not allowed to do what? Lo tikach isha mibenos kanan. You're allowed to get married, and of course I want you to come home with a nice girl, but make sure that she is not going to be from the land of Canaan. What right did Yitzchak Avinu have to tell his son where he should get married, and who he should marry? Didn't we just say that there's no kibud av v'em when it comes to getting married? So that's a big question. How do you deal with the story of Yitzchak and Yaakov? And what right did Yitzchak have to basically limit his son and say, you can only find a girl to marry from this community, not from that one, because I don't like the other ones? Who cares what you like? If I happen to fall in love with a girl from Canaan, I should be able to marry her regardless, irrespective of what you think. That's the question that the Torah Tamima raises. Okay, another point to be aware of is a discussion that the Rambam and the other Rishonim have. The Tur and the Rambam have a dispute. What happens when you have a case of Aviv Rasha? What happens when you have a case? It doesn't mean my father is a Rasha, but it means either my father or my mother. One of the parents is a Rasha, is a evil person. Do I have an obligation of Kibud av v'em toward a Rasha or not? Now, it's important to point out that Pesachei Tshuva writes in Yerudeya, what does it mean when someone is a Rasha? It doesn't mean they've done something wrong in their life. All of us do things wrong. Some people do worse things and some people do things that are not as bad. Aviv Rasha means when your parent is a real, objectively bad person, has done hurtful, bad things to you or to others. That would be what everyone would agree upon. We're not talking about picking nitty-gritty things that our parents may do. Everyone's parents make mistakes. Everyone's parents do things that they maybe shouldn't do because everyone's parents are human beings. And that's okay. And we all need to realize that we should give our parents a pass once in a while because they are human beings, and you too someday will be a parent, and you too will make mistakes, and it's not something that you want to do. It's not something that you're intending to do. It's unfortunate that this is the circumstance of life. This is what happens. So the Rambam says, even if Aviv Rasha, even if one's parent is an absolute Rasha, says the Rambam, you have an obligation to be mechabed that parent. And the Tur disagrees vehemently, and he says, if my parent is the embodiment of evil, is a terrible person, let's give the extreme example that we gave last week. Someone's parent is a child molester, right? So everybody in the world would agree that that person is evil. That's the epitome of evil. That's horrible. You ruin people's lives. So in that case, would I have an obligation of kibud av v'em? So the Rambam says yes, and the Tur says no. How does that trickle down into the halacha? The Shulchan Aruch writes the following. Mamzer, that's the case we spoke about before. If I have a mamzer, now by definition, the parent of a mamzer is what? a rasha, because the parent of a mamzer married someone or continues to live with someone that they're not allowed to be married to. So says the Shulchan Aruch, what do you do when you have a child who's a mamzer? Do they have an obligation of kibud av ha'em or not? Writes the Shulchan Aruch, quoting the Rambam, mamzer has to make sure to be mechabed his parents. And the Ramah comes along and he says, I don't think he's mechuyev to be mechabed his parents unless his parents do tshuva. Now, how does a person prove that they've done tshuva? This is a really interesting case to think about. How does a person ever prove to another human being that they have done tshuva? Are there ever situations where we would say a person has done something so bad that tshuva is not possible? I don't know the answer. I'm throwing it out to everyone to think about. Give that example of a child molester, Rachmana Litzlan, right? You have that case. They've ruined people's lives forever. People are going to be traumatized forever because of what they may have done, what they did do. Now this person, 25 years go by, they sat in jail, they actually feel terrible remorse for everything they did, but in the end of the day, people's lives are destroyed. Is there ever a possibility for tshuva for such a person? I'm not talking about psychologically, can they actually be cured or not? I have no idea. That's for experts to decide. I'm talking about from the Torah perspective. What?
Theoretically, yes.
Theoretically, yes. You think so?
Anyone.
So you're saying anyone can do tshuva. If it says that somebody who serves Avodah Zarah can do tshuva, then how could it be that somebody who's a child molester can't do tshuva? Doesn't make sense. The difference is Avodah Zarah is between you and God. Child molesters between you and another person. You destroyed another person's life, and that person continues to suffer because of you. So is there a cutoff point where we would say, you know what, maybe after 25 years, we'll accept your tshuva. If you're really sincere, maybe 30 years, 40 years, when is that? Is there ever a point in a person's life where you say, you know what, enough time has passed where you can actually do tshuva? Yeah?
Doesn't the Rambam say that there's certain things like Yom Kippur is not
correct. The Rambam quotes the Gemara. That there are certain things that even Yom Kippur is not mechaper. It's true. But is there a difference between kapara, meaning he asks mechila, he goes to all the victims and says, like, I want you to know if I can replay my life, if I can do this again. I never would have hurt you. I didn't, you know, whatever it is, whatever excuse he gives, takes full responsibility, full ownership, doesn't give excuses, says, I did wrong, I'm evil, I'm terrible. Is there ever a point where you're willing to say, what? So that's a question, right? The Gemara says in Maseches Yuma that let's say somebody comes to me legitimately and asks my mechila, and I just can't bring myself to be mocha that person. How many times do they have to keep coming to me? The Gemara says they come three different times in three different settings when it's appropriate for them to do so. We're not talking about that 5 minutes apart from each other they come back to me, but in three different opportunities that they have, they come to confront me about the issue and they're very sincerely asking for my forgiveness. If at some point I don't forgive them, they move on with life. So I don't know. I don't know the answer to this. I think it's a really interesting question. Like, is there ever a point where we would say someone cannot do tshuva? This actually came up. There were Nazis who felt so guilty years after the war who wanted to be Megayer. You know that. Many of them wanted to, not many, but there was a group of them that wanted to convert. And it was a major controversy in Israel. Should we ever allow a Nazi to convert after they did jail time or whatever it may be? They were complicit to the act of murdering the Jewish people. Are there limits to tshuva? Is there ever a limit where we would say, I'm sorry, like you were a guard for a concentration camp, and therefore I don't care how sincere you are now that you're 85 years old, but it's too bad. You have ruined and destroyed too many Jewish lives and too many Jewish families, and therefore we don't accept you. Is that a Jewish concept? Does that work? I don't know. It's a very... very interesting question. So here the Rambam says that we should be mechabed someone who, even if they're a Rasha, even if the parent is a Rasha. And the Rambam says, we are not obligated to respect Aviv Rasha. That is not an obligation that we have. And that, again, as I mentioned, is a very, very relevant and important question to think about as well. Now, what is the halacha when it comes to the mitzvah of, when it comes to the mitzvah, I see we're almost finished, right? When it comes to the mitzvah of, let's say, kibud av ha'em and the mitzvah of Talmud Torah. So I want to go to Stern College. Why do I want to go to Stern College? Not because the education is so amazing. I go to Harvard, the education is better. It's not why I want to be here. Why do I want to be here? Does nobody want to be here? I want to be here because hopefully I can learn more, I can grow more, I can be a better Jew. Otherwise, you shouldn't be here, right? There's no reason to pay this money to be here. Nachon? I assume. So I'm here only because I want an education, very nice, but I also want to grow as a Jew. So I think it will be better for my spirituality to be here. My parents don't care. My parents say, you're mature, you're 21 years old, you'll figure out if you want to be self-motivated to be spiritual, then be spiritual and be a growing person. And if not, it's your problem. But you should go to Harvard before the anti-Semitism, right? You should go to Harvard. You should go to Yale. You shouldn't come here. And I insist that I want to come here. So is the mitzvah of Kibbutz Av Em demand of me that I listen to my parents or not? So the Gemara says in Megillah, Daf Tazayin Amud Beis, Gadol Talmud Torah Yoser Mikibbutz Av Em. It's a Gemara explicitly that says Talmud Torah is more important than Kibbutz Av Em, which means, it may not be a wise idea. If my parents are going to be so upset, they're going to cut me off and say, we want to have no relationship with you, it's probably not healthy. It's probably not a good idea. But I'm just talking theoretically. Do I have an obligation to listen to my parents when they play that card of, oh, keep it of aim. You got to go to Yale, keep it of aim. The answer is, keep it of aim is not relevant. If I think that my opportunities for Limud HaTorah are going to be better if I go to a different location than my parents wish me to go to, I'm allowed to make the decision that I want. Now, again, it may not be smart because maybe my parents know what's better for me than I myself know. But outside of that consideration, the halacha would not expect of me to listen to my parents when they are demanding something that would hinder my opportunities toward growth in Limud HaTorah. And the same question is raised when it comes to the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. What happens when I want to make aliyah and my parents say, but we don't want to be so far away from you. We want you to stay here. That is a major discussion in the Acharonim. Exactly how do we look at that and what should the halacha be when it comes to the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. So, the Maharami Rutenberg is famous for saying, Maharami Rutenberg was the Rebbe of the Rush. Maharami Rutenberg writes that a child does not have to listen to their parents when the parents say, we want you to stay in Chutzlars, we don't want you to make Aliyah. What right do you have to tell me not to make Aliyah? After all, Aliyah, living in Eretz Yisrael, seems to be a mitzvah. What kind of mitzvah it is doesn't matter, but it seems to be a mitzvah. So after all, it seems that I wouldn't have to listen to my parents. Now the problem is, that the psukim say in the beginning of Parshas Lech Lecha, Avram Avinu, Lech Lecha me'artzecha mimoladetecha el ha'aretz asher arecha. Avram Avinu leaves his parents' home, goes to Eretz Yisrael, and he leaves his parents behind. So what about Kibbutz Av Em? Don't you see from there? What do you see from there? That obviously going to Eretz Yisrael is more important than Kibbutz Av Em, right? That's the simple level of understanding. That's the way you understand it. Ah, along comes the Medrash in Parshas Lech Lecha, and it says, Lech Lecha, Lecha means I'm instructing only you. And says the Medrash, Ani poter oscha mi kibbut av aim. You, Avram Avinu, have a pass on kibbut av aim. Ooh, what's the implication from that? That only you, Avram Avinu, who is instructed by the Ribbono Shel Olam himself, you have a pass on kibbut av aim, but every subsequent person and any subsequent generation who wants to all of a sudden disregard Kibbutz Av Em and move to Eretz Yisrael, it sounds like they may not have a right to do that because Kibbutz Av Em is a very important mitzvah. So that is the problematic medrash. How do you deal with that medrash? The Maharami Rutenberg says, of course, if a child wants to move to Eretz Yisrael, of course they should do that. My parents are objecting. They're saying, we don't want you to be so far away. We want you to be here. We think it's safe, whatever it may be. Says the Maharami Rutenberg, I don't have to listen to them because I have a mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael that is more important to me than the mitzvah of Kibbutz Av Em. It doesn't mean that I don't respect my parents. It just means I respect the Ribbono Shel Olam more than I respect my parents. Again, just to frame it in that way, it's not that I don't care about my parents. It's just that my priorities are going to be a little bit different. The problem that you need to figure out is, how do you deal with that medrash in Parshas Lech Lecha, where the medrash seems to indicate that the only allowance that was given for someone to disregard Kibbutz Av Em for the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael was only given to Avram Avinu in his generation, but it seems to imply that anyone subsequently who wants to do the same may not have a right to do that. That is a major discussion in the poskim to try to figure out how to handle that particular medrash. What do you do to get out of that? But the bottom line, Rav Avadia writes in a tshuva that he thinks that this would fall under the guidelines of a general child who wants to do the right thing, who wants to do a mitzvah, and their parents are objecting to them doing so. We don't have an obligation to listen to our parents. To the contrary, we should listen to HaKadosh Baruch Hu over our parents. Yeah?
Why do you say